We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
Well, we come to the last of our studies, number 7. On concern for people's salvation. We used to call this motivation for evangelism. I've forgotten why we changed the title. I suppose it's a little bit of a gentler title, and it certainly does pick up the theme of the words, concern for salvation. For poor acts so that they may be saved. Throughout the studies, if you've been following these one after another, although if you've just sat and listened to 6 tapes, I think you need to get some bonus points and go and have a cup of coffee before you start yet another one. But if you have been following it through, we've seen that the gospel itself brings people into relationship with God because of what God has done for us. And we'll push us through the work of the Spirit and the teaching of the Scriptures into good works that God has made us to do. We will express our faith to God in prayer, but we will be concerned now about other people, because as we grow like God, we will grow into being concerned for other people, for our God is concerned for others. On one hand, this will be a concern for the new family that we have joined, as new for us anyway, the family of God. And they will be encouraging one another, spurring one another on to love and to good deeds. But it's not only the household of good, a household of faith for whom we will do good. As Paul says in Galatians 6, let us do good to all men, especially the household of faith. It's our love for one another which marks us out as Christians. But our love for one another is not ultimately exclusive. Our neighbour is any man and every man for whom there is need, for whom we have opportunity to help, as we have opportunity, says Paul, let us do good to every man. And so my concern for my neighbour will not only be my Christian neighbour, but all mankind. But what will be the fundamental character of my concern for others? Is to do good, and any good at that. But what is the ultimate good? But to bring them into that same relationship with God that I now enjoy. To save them from the eternal condemnation that God has rightly and very graciously declared to us will take place. It will be concern for other people's salvation. The new Christian often grasps this more clearly than the old Christian. For the new Christian, having just come to understand the rescue that has taken place in their own life, that they have been saved from the very jaws of hell, is often very much more concerned about his brothers, his sisters, his parents, his children, about the people around about who he would be with just a week or two before, but now has been rescued out of their condemnation, out of their situation. The old Christian tends to get caught up with the cares of this world and tends to think that the good for mankind has got to do with material growth and economic security, which in themselves are not bad things, but which are not the fundamental good. This study should, in some ways, lead on to our other course on 2 ways to live in personal evangelism. If you haven't heard about that course, then you could write to us at the University of New South Wales or the Anglican Information Office. It's, of course, giving people some practice, some experience, some training, some model in how to evangelise. The study here isn't on how to evangelise, but on being concerned to evangelise. And so we've picked a passage, which I think is one of the great passages upon which to base a theology of evangelism, 1 Corinthians chapters 8, 9, 10, through to chapter 11, verse 1. And what we've done is we've picked the very last couple of verses, the summation of the argument. In chapter 10, verse 33, through to 11, verse 1.
I try to please everybody in every way, for I'm not seeking my own good but the good of many, so that they may be saved. Follow my example, as I follow the example of Christ. Well, again, we go from context to content to the point of the study, so let's look at the context first. Corinthians is a rich epistle, full of concern and pastoral advice for a congregation that is a real mixed bag of people. People who have been remarkably saved, rescued, washed clean by the work of the gospel, but who are living a life of real confusion. It's a church where evangelism has clearly taken place. Churches which are stable and steady and don't have the kinds of problems of Corinth are churches where people haven't been converted lately. But churches where there's lots of people converted recently have got all the kinds of problems that Corinth have got. It's rich and vibrant and alive, but boy, is it a mess. One of the great messy issues which forms a basis of fighting and division within Corinth is the issue of what to do with food offered to idols. Now, this doesn't seem on first account to be much of an issue for us today. In our Western world, we don't have butchers offering up meat to this idol or to that idol. But in Corinth in the first century, it most likely was hard to buy a lump of steak that hadn't been offered up to some idol, hadn't been involved in some temple sacrifice. For the Jew who traditionally, and by his scriptures, was not to have anything to do with idols, such meat was offensive. To the Gentile, who had just come out of idolatry, who had come away from the superstition and fear and terror, the intrigue and the spiritual domination of idolatry, it could equally be something that is abhorrent and that he wished to free himself from. And yet, if you had understood the gospel properly, you would understand that there is no God but one, and that the idols are false and phony gods, and that we need not fear the powers of the evil ones, because God has won the great victory in Jesus Christ. And so the knowledge of the gospel has given some people a real liberty about idols. Some say, well, I don't mind where the meat's been offered to. Meat's meat, I'm eating the meat. God is the giver of meat. I receive it with thanksgiving to God, and I don't worry about it. Others, on the other hand, were saying, no, you can't really do that. That meat is now offered to Diana, offered to Artemis, offered to this one or that one, and is contaminated by the spirits, by the powers. And so even within the Christian fellowship, there was division. The non-Christian may also, of course, watch the Christian to see how far his Christianity is going to take him out of the culture of the religious practices of the first century, or how much you can be a Christian and accept this new God in with the other gods that are already available. Some of the Christians, it would seem, have gone so far down the track as to even be involved in going along to the temple services. After all, there's no such thing as an idol. There's no God other than the real God. And they put on a good performance down there. They run a nice show, and I don't mind being involved there with the family and the requirements of the family and the friends. And you can always get your meat cheaper after the sacrifice down the temple than in the butcher shop later. There's a whole range of reasons. I trust that you understand. I say with tongue in cheek, there's a whole range of reasons for which people could be thought of going down to the temple services. And those who have got this new superior knowledge of the non-existence of idols could easily be given to going. What's Paul's advice? Well, it's a complex argument he uses. On the one hand, he must agree with those who have got that knowledge and the liberty and freedom, but only up to a certain point. Being involved in idolatry itself cannot be right. On the other hand, he must defend the brothers whose consciences are still bound, who are worried and who feel it's wrong, because it can't be right to disobey your conscience. And so Paul is trying to keep people together and show them the way forward through the minefield of this complex issue. Those of you who are overseas students studying here in Australia for a while and in Southeast Asia, this is a very important passage, because the family shrine, the ancestor worship, this is the very passage that deals with the kind of issue that you're caught up in very often. That if you do not lay fruit before the shrine, then your family think that you've got no respect for your ancestors. And yet if you do, well, does that mean that you believe your ancestors still exist and need to be appeased and their spirits are still an influence within the household? It's a real problem. Even in Australia, you can see a parallel as to whether or not you play rock music. There are some Christians who think it's of the devil. There are other Christians who think it's just noise. There are some who think it's nice noise and some who think it's nasty noise, but there's a great diversity of opinion as to whether or not Christians can or cannot, should or should not be involved in that kind of subculture, that kind of religious culture. Well, I'm not entering into it. I'm picking up on what the passage is about. One of the key parts of the passage is chapter 9, where Paul says, I've become all things to all men. Now you remember the passage, don't you? Because that part's often taken just without any reference to its context. He says, I am a free man. I don't belong to anybody, but my freedom is used for the service of other people. And so you who are free, who know that there is no God but one and that the idols don't exist, you may be free, but just being free doesn't mean that you can now go and do whatever you like. You still are obliged to other people, obliged to serving other people, obliged to serving people who are not themselves free. And so though I am free, I become a slave to everyone else, he says. To the Jew I become like a Jew, to the Greek, to those under the law I become as one under the law, to those outside the law I become as one outside the law. To the weak I become weak. You know, none of those things. Oh, he was a Jew, but he is not outside the law, just any more than he's under the law. He is not himself weak, but he does all these things. He puts himself out for other people. Why? It's in chapter 9, verse 19 following. I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jew I become like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law I become like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those who have not the law I become as like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak I become weak to win the weak. Paul puts himself out for other people that they may be one. And he concludes, I have become all things to all men so that by all possible means I might save some. I do this for the sake of the gospel that I may share in its blessings. I take verse 23. It actually means that he does it so that he might be Christian. Being Christian does not mean living your own life your own way. Being Christian means living like Christ. And living like Christ means putting yourself in service of other people that they may be saved. Making myself a slave. Jesus was free. Jesus was in glory. But he who is rich became poor so that we who are poor may become rich. It's the same kind of argument. That one comes from 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Jesus was born of a woman, born under the law, so as to redeem those who are under the law. He was the lawgiver. He was the creator of women. And yet he placed himself into subjection, became a man, became a servant, even died on a cross in order to save other people. So Paul says, likewise, I become, free as I am, I become a slave to others to win them. He goes on in chapter 10 to discuss idolatry and say how there comes a point at which you can't go, which you cannot be involved. But just eating meat is not it. And he says, if you've got a free conscience to eat the meat afterwards, well, eat it by all means. But if somebody else's conscience is bound up and they say, hey, hang on, that's idols, then don't eat it. Not for the sake of your conscience is free, but for the sake of his conscience, because you don't want to jeopardize him. You don't want to put him offside with the gospel and offside with God. You know the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, but they don't know that. And you mustn't act in such a way that you will lose some, but rather put yourself out so that you may save some. And so to the strong, to the well-educated, to the mature, to the knowledgeable Christian, Paul says, don't let your knowledge puff you up, but live not by your knowledge, but by your love. For love will seek to build up the other person. And so, because you love them, although you are free, you will put yourself into their service. You'll not live to please yourself, you'll live to serve them, to please them for their salvation. And so we come to the end of the argument, which I've abbreviated and left some details out of, so do go back and study it. The end of the argument from verse 31 says, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jew, Greek, or the church of God. Don't let anyone be a cause of stumbling to anybody, even as I don't. What I try to do is I try to please everybody in every way. We're coming to the text now then. He seeks to please everybody in every way. Christians are not to be unpleasant people, we're pleasant people, seeking to please people. Oh, it's easy to stick up for your own rights, but that's not Christian. Christian is to bend and compromise for other people, even when you know you're in the right, to put yourself out for other people. Even when you don't like that choice of music, to go along with it. Even when you don't really follow that form of football, to go and watch it and be interested in it. Even when you don't like that form of clothing or colour, to actually put yourself out for other people, to follow the fashions that will not cause offence, to seek to please everybody in every way, he says. Whoever they may be, Jew, Greek, outside the law, under the law. Why, it was more complex in Paul's day as a Jew and the old Pharisee. And yet, he seeked to live in whatever way that the group he was with were living. We know this in missionary work. We expect that when you go to Argentina to be a missionary, you will take on learning Spanish and the Argentinian culture. Well, so it is in a many way in terms of your family, your neighbours, your fellow students. Whoever you're moving with, you are not to be the person who sticks out as the odd, difficult, obstreperous, cussed person, but rather the pleasant person who gets along with everybody in every way. And of course, that can mean you can do sin. No, Paul says, no, you don't go that far. Short of sin, you bend. You're doing all to the glory of God. You cannot sin to the glory of God. So you do it to the glory of God. You seek to please everybody in your own way. In other words, you do not seek to please yourself, but others. I am free not to serve myself, but to serve others, Galatians chapter 5. Why do I want to be pleasant to everybody? So as to be Mr. Nice Guy, so that everybody will like me? No. That would still be pleasing myself, wouldn't it? I do this, he says, not seeking my own good. If I sought my own good, then I would do my own thing. No, I'm seeking other people's good. And if I did it so as to be Mr. Nice Guy, then I'd be seeking my own good, but I'm not doing that. I'm trying to be pleasant to everybody so that I might seek their good. Not my good, but the good of many. And what is the good of many? What is the good that I'm seeking for them? It's spelled out for us at the end of chapter 10, verse 33 there, so that they may be saved. That's the good of many, that they may be saved, that they might come into that relationship with God through Jesus Christ that I now have, that they might avoid the wrath of God that is to come upon the works of ungodliness and all ungodly men, that they might know the mercy and forgiveness and pardon of God, that we may win them, as Paul puts it in chapter 9, that they may be saved. It's for their good that I do this. If I don't do it, I tend not to save them. I tend to be quarrelling with them about the colour of clothing, the kinds of cars, the type of football, the character of food. I argue with them about issues that are not the gospel. I do not make the gospel clear. I confuse it with 1,000 other irrelevant issues. Whereas if I live in their culture and accept all the norms of their lifestyle, then the only thing over which I'm going to disagree and differ with them, excuse me, coughing for you, the only thing I'm going to disagree and differ is the gospel itself, and so it becomes crystal clear. It is made a point. I just have a daughter walking into the room. I'm actually up making this tape very early in the morning, and she wonders why I'm sitting in a room talking to myself, and she's just got up. So I've got to give a quick cuddle and a hello here. strange things to have in a tape, isn't it? To have that personal note. She still looks asleep, so why don't you hop into bed with Mum for a little while? So now you know I've got a son and a daughter.
Well, I've got another daughter too, but that's another story.
Let's back to Paul. Here is the goal, to save other people. To so put myself out that others may be saved. Not to live for myself, but for them, because the ultimate good for them is that they be saved. And the way to do that is to make the gospel clear. And the way to make the gospel clear is to make no difference between me and the people around about me, except the gospel. And so that is why, of course, I won't be going sinning in order to be like them. Because that's where the line is drawn. But I'll be living all the time to seek their salvation. Now what Paul's saying here in chapters 10, verses 33 to 11, verse 1, is that this is normative Christian living. Because he goes on to say, follow my example. He calls upon us, commands us, orders us to do it this way. That's why, see, evangelism is not just an optional extra for Christians. It is called upon for all Christians to live for the salvation of other people, to submit their own likes and desires to the salvation of other people, to adapt their lifestyle to the salvation of other people. But lest you think that Paul is going beyond the bounds of what is called a Christian, notice what else he says. Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ, because what I am doing here is fundamentally what Christ does. You want to grow into Christ-likeness of character? You want to be like Christ? Well, to be like Christ is to lay down your life for other people's salvation. That is what Jesus did, is it not? Took up his cross for other people's salvation. And he calls upon us to take up our cross. We're to have the same mind that Christ had. He didn't think equality with God was a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself and took the form of a servant in Philippians chapter 2. Now we're to be like Paul, who was like Christ. Though rich, became poor, so that the poor may become rich. And the real rich and the real poverty he's speaking of here is not economic, of course, but spiritual. Who put himself out, who didn't do just what he wanted to do, but did what others wanted to do, so that they may be saved. Here is the real motivation for evangelism. Now, we're not dealing with preaching the gospel and what words to say and how to go about doing it. As I said earlier, you get that from our whole course on Two Ways to Live. We're talking about the motivation, the way in which to relate and to live in the non-Christian world. Not to be in judgment of them, not to be in condemnation of them, but seeking them, longing for them, loving them, desiring them, working for them, submitting ourselves to them, bending our lives to save them. Follow the example of Paul and the example of Christ, the example of love. Now we raise this issue because here are part of the good works that God wants us to walk in. Other people's salvation, this other person-centeredness, is fundamentally the good works that God wants us to walk in. And new Christians are the very best evangelists because they're the ones who've got the greatest number of non-Christian friendships. And they're the ones whose changed life is observable in the community because it is just change or just changing. And we need to teach them that the greatest thing they can do for people is to bring them to the Lord Jesus. And that being a Christian does not lead you then to be disagreeable with people, but actually to be more pleasant with people. Desire to be pleasant because you have a real motivation to be pleasant now, not just self-seeking pleasantry, but pleasant so that they can be benefited by salvation. And we need to teach the new Christians to seek the real issues, the big issues, the gospel, and to leave aside the small issues, the unimportant issues, to bend and compromise, to be flexible over the things that really don't matter, in order to be firm and resolute in the things of the gospel that do matter. And we need to encourage new Christians to be like Christ. And to be like Christ. And what does that mean? To live your life, to lay down your life for other people's salvation. That is being like Christ. And like God, who didn't spare his son, but gave him for us, that we may be forgiven. A Christian can never really come to the point of following Christ without being committed to the evangelization of the world. For God's Son was the ultimate evangelist, and we are to follow him in his example.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.